Hey everyone, Chat Cemetery is back. I'm your host, Deanna Chapman, and today I am joined once again by Katie Schaefer, and we are talking about the novel, The Outsider. Here's your spoiler alert, everyone. I know we're talking about more recent stuff here, but we are talking about everything that happens in this book. This is one that I actually did backwards. I watched the TV show before reading the book, and wow, some things are different, Katie.
Are they? I haven't watched the show yet. I've been like, okay, I'm going to do it and I'm going to binge it all, but parts of it are really dark. So I was like, I don't know. It's already a dark time in the world. Do I really want to add more to it?
Well, I won't spoil any of the show for you, but I will say that I have absolutely no recollection of all of the Texas stuff.
Oh, okay.
Being in the show, I think some of it is like in the show, but I don't think it's Texas. I could be wrong. I watched it when it came out for reasons that I don't really know, because I knew I was going to watch it for this, but I guess I just wanted to like keep up with the conversation or something. But I do have to say, the book, very good. I feel like people are kind of on both sides of the fence with this one, where people either really don't like it all that much or people really do enjoy it. And obviously we'll get to ratings later, but overall, how did you feel about this book?
This was one of the, like, because I read this book way back when it came out as well. And that at the time, I think it was one of the first things I read after that he wrote a significant chunk of time after his accident. So what I see a lot of online people calling like his new style, like people say that these are different than from before, which I don't know that I agree with, but I really liked this one, and I was kind of reading it in that mindset of like, does this feel different? And not really. I mean, I've read enough King that it's like, well, it's no more different than like the Green Mile's writing style, for example, is from Carrie. Like, those are two very different stylistic books. And I'm sure part of it is due to age, but it also just seemed like, and I haven't read his Mr. Mercedes books, which this kind of relates to. So I was wondering, I was like, maybe this is really his, it's not exactly hard-boiled, but it's definitely leans towards that at times.
He's going through a crime phase, I would say.
Yeah, yeah. And I've wanted to read the Mr. Mercedes because I've heard they're good. And I really like the guy who's the lead actor in that show.
Brendan Gleeson?
Yes, I think he's fabulous, especially at this kind of a role that I've heard the Mr. Mercedes character is. Mm-hmm. So, but yeah, what did you think?
I was a little wary going into it because I knew how brutal it was going to be, having seen the show and knowing that even though the show was on HBO, it probably tamed certain elements of King's story down a little bit, because King is really, really good at writing children characters. But in this story, he's writing about children in a completely different, wildly morbid way, you know, because for the most part, you know, the main kid that this focuses on is dead right from the start, pretty much. So you have this whole town mentality. I think you really see bits and pieces of this town mentality like we do in Under the Dome, just to a lesser extent, because we're not so focused on as many characters. But, you know, Terry Maitland was the little league coach. Everyone loved this guy. And multiple people, multiple eyewitnesses picked him out as the guy last seen with the boy alive.
Right. And then coming out of the woods with blood on his shirt. And those are some pretty, and people liked him enough that they all just kind of were like, with the blood, were just kind of like, oh, because he excuses it away with saying he has a nosebleed. And they're like, well, that seems a little weird, but it's Terry. He wouldn't do anything wrong. And then this happens. And I think the book opens with his arrest, right? On the, when they're coaching, he's coaching that little league game and they just descend upon him.
That's pretty close to the beginning. And then you kind of work your way through the story backwards as they're trying to solve the crime. And you have Frankie, the boy who was absolutely mutilated, raped after the fact, I think it was. And then, you know, this story is just so hard to read at times, because it's one thing when King has adult characters go through all of these horrible things. And, you know, like I said, we've seen him put kids through the ringer, but never in quite the same way.
Yeah, this feels more detached almost in a certain way, which fits in more with like the mystery crime book aspect of it, because those are typically fairly detached from the victim. And he does that. And I think really the only time we get a kid's perspective in this is from Maitland's daughter, who's seeing the outsider. And even then, it's just a brief little glimpse of it. And I think even that brief glimpse feels very like, okay, King, as usual, King knows how to write kids. But this one, it feels almost more brutal because we don't learn a whole lot about Frankie. He is just kind of the crime victim. And that's not usual for a King book. Like, character development is very big in King's stuff. And in this, we don't get a whole lot about the person whose death started this whole adventure. Terrible, terrible adventure.
Yeah. And Grace is the daughter who is, you know, seeing the outsider. And because she's the younger of the two, everyone is kind of finding it hard to believe her. But as a reader, we all know from previous King novels that you kind of always have to believe the kids. You know, I just finished reading The Institute recently, too. That definitely has like Firestarter vibes all over again with, you know, right, more characters, more kids. You have It, where they're kind of just going through this thing on their own and no one in town is really helping them at all by any means, because
right,
one, they're too scared to tell the adults, and two, they know even if they do, they won't be believed. But all of those kids are older than Grace. So, you know, Grace is just saying these things and telling everyone the truth, but it's so bizarre what she's saying that they don't really believe her. And, you know, you mentioned the Bill Hodges trilogy, and Holly Gibney comes into play in this. And I was surprised how long it took, because I could have sworn she was in more of the show. I could be wrong, because I haven't seen the series since it premiered in January of last year. And as we all know, it has been a very, very long, almost year and a half now of this,
yeah,
roughly a year and a half now of this. By the time everyone is listening to this, it's been about a year and a half of the whole pandemic thing. And this happened before that, and it somehow seems like a lifetime ago.
Yeah, exactly. Like January 2020, that was like 20 years ago. Oh my
yeah. God. Yeah. So I apologize. My memory is a little hazy with the show, but I'll probably talk about more of the differences in that episode, because with the novels obviously being the source material, it's always interesting to me what the shows do decide to change. And I think the way King wrote this was very specific in its intent. Like you said, the murder feels more detached. And I think that is what makes it so brutal, too, because Frankie is never really a character we get to care about before this happens.
Yeah. Yeah, we're seeing him from the perspective, for the most part, from the investigative team, and then, you know, Howie, Terry's lawyer, and a little bit of from Terry's perspective. It feels more like a crime show, like where we have this nameless victim almost that then kind of we get a little bit of glimpse into, but it's not necessarily about, like, this book is not about Frankie. This book is about, you know, what happens because of Frankie's death, and how that affects both Terry and then his inner circle, and then the detectives who are trying to figure out, like, what the heck actually happened here. Because, you know, from their perspective initially, it does seem reasonable. They have all of this, what they feel is ironclad evidence. But as Terry's lawyer points out, he's like, yeah, but you didn't actually do any checking. You took all those people seriously, but you didn't actually check Terry's whereabouts. You didn't talk to him first. You just assumed you had something and swooped in. And I think that obviously the reason for that in the book is because of the brutality of the crime, is that they don't want to give anything away and spook Terry because they think he's just going to run. And that works really well within the book, I think, that they did just go off half-cocked.
Yeah. And you have the fact that the ADA, Bill Samuels, is the one sort of pointing this case in a very specific direction. And you have Ralph Anderson, the main detective, who knows this family. He's known Terry for years. And, you know, Terry coached his son, who they talk about a lot, but he's like MIA the whole story.
Yep. Yeah, we never get to meet him or anything like that. And his, I really like the fact that we also get from Jeannie, his wife, that there's, it's almost, you know, the detective and his assistant or side worker, where she's giving perspective. And even though she's not a detective, her perspective is at points in the book totally invaluable. And that is what helps Ralph really see, like, maybe I do need to keep more of an open mind, because this is like, it gets to a point of, okay, it's a little weird. You know, we've got this alibi. And then as the alibi becomes more and more concrete, it starts to get weirder and weirder. And then once they bring Holly into things and she starts spilling the tea about, okay, this is what I found, like, then it just turns the weird up to 11. And it really feels like Jeannie is the only reason Ralph can really accept that, because he loves this woman so much, and that she's able to accept it and willing to work within this framework, he's able to do so as well, eventually. Not reversed, but first he's like, this is not true and you're crazy.
Yeah. And we have two massive events that really turn the tides of this novel twice. First, you have Frankie's murder, and that really sets you up to think, okay, they already arrested the guy. This can't be the whole story. Right. So you are basically starting with the end result and kind of working your way backwards through this to find out the truth. And I kind of like that he does it that way, because even though obviously this is still going in chronological order, as far as with the crime, it feels like it's all happening backwards.
It's like you said, it's chronological, but then it also kind of plays what King does incredibly well, plays with time so that we are still getting the past from the current perspective. It works really well within this book, and it's not too much, because I think you really could have gone overboard. Like, this did not need, you know, like an It level where we are going back and forth in time and seeing the murder and all of that. Like, there's just enough of it to make it, to give it some perspective, I think.
Exactly. And he easily could have made the timeline super confusing for this, especially with, you know, the quote unquote two Terrys, you know. So I'm glad that it was done the way it was done and it was easy to follow that way. And, you know, the second massive event is Terry being shot outside the courthouse by Frankie's brother. Also, everything that happens to the Peterson family, absolutely terrible.
Yes. Just crushing. It's crushing. And that's not anything new for King. And like, you can kind of tell it's coming. And you could just see, like, okay. Like in Under the Dome with the guy who eventually commits suicide. I can't remember his name. But like, he's lost his whole family. Like, I think he's the one who sees his wife bleed out in front of him right as the dome comes down. Her hand gets cut off. And he just slowly loses his mind. And you can tell from the point after his wife has died in his arms that, like, there's no coming back for this guy. And that's very much how it feels for the Peterson family. And I will say, so I had this book spoiled for me, which was terrible because it was a review. And I was reading, I was like, oh, do I want to give this a try? So I read this review. And in, like, the first two sentences, it says, you know, that who the outsider is and all of this. And I was like, oh, well, that must not be like a huge part. Like, King must get into that right away. And then I learn as I'm reading the book, like, no, what's going on is actually like the first half of the mystery. And it's not truly revealed until like a halfway point. You don't really figure out what's going on. And I was like, this is not cool. And I was still able to enjoy the book, but it did give me a different perspective of knowing that, like, it definitely wasn't Terry who killed him. There is a doppelganger and all of that. It was like, but I was really frustrated when I figured that out about 4 pages in, that was the mystery that we were trying to solve, or the first mystery. There are more mysteries that come along, but... So if you came to this book after watching the show, you also knew that that was the twist, right?
Yeah. And, you know, I think the show did a pretty good job of adapting this. Now that I've read the book, they do have some changes, as they all do. You know, right. You and I have recently watched Lacey's story, and, you know, that definitely changes some things up from the book. And a lot of these stories are sometimes hard to tell the way King tells them in a visual format.
Yeah.
And I think because this has more of the crime element, you know, it's something that people are more used to seeing on screen. So, you know, this, and I just finished watching Mr. Mercedes recently too, that crime element, as long as you don't make it feel like Law and Order, you know,
mm-hmm.
I think... Mm-hmm. You're going to draw in a lot of people, because you'll still draw in some people who love Law and Order. And I have nothing against that series of shows, because obviously SVU has been on for like 23 seasons or something. So they know what they're doing. But I think for a King novel, especially the crime ones, it still wouldn't make sense to adapt it that way, because it's not a weekly crime thing that you can do over 10 episodes. It's one crime. In this case, it's still multiple crimes, but, you
right.
know, it's not enough to have that sort of procedural feel. And oftentimes, King's crime stuff doesn't really follow procedure.
No. I mean, this gets close, I think, with like the detective work that happens in it. But it's still, once the supernatural element becomes apparent in it, all of that kind of goes out the window. Once you have the detective coming to the suspect's wife and trying to interview her and all of that. Well, I mean, does that happen after he dies? I know it's right around that time.
I want to say it's just before, yeah.
Like once they start realizing like, well, this is not everything is adding up here. You know, like detectives don't usually go and, yeah, I'll keep what you say to myself, you know, and that's, but it works within the context of this kind of supernatural crime story. And too much procedure would have made this feel just so dry.
Mm-hmm.
And it wouldn't have worked if you're also trying to, you know, include the really freaky aspects of the doppelganger part of this. Because at first it's just kind of weird and creepy. And then as they reveal more and more of the reality of what this creature is, it gets more and more upsetting as you see the trail that this creature has left across the country, the world, killing children and feeding off of all of them and their family's misery.
Yeah. I totally agree with you that it would have been more dry if there were more of the procedural cop talk stuff in this. And I think the fact, too, that they bring in Alec Pelley, who is a private detective, kind of helps ease that, because he's sort of in this gray area. He has rules that he has to follow, but he's not a cop. So he doesn't have all of the same rules that they have to follow. And, you know, he has a little more freedom. He is basically trying to beat the cops at their own game, too, so that Howie can sort of have this upper hand, Howie being the lawyer for Terry Maitland. And you see all of these people in the end come together in a way that at the beginning of the book, you wouldn't expect. But King does that legwork to make sure that all of these characters are going to come together in the end. And, you know, you throw Holly into the mix too, because Alec, I believe, is the one who is like, oh, hey, I've heard of this person. And, you know, at this point in time, we don't really know why it was just Holly and not Bill who came, because I think as soon as Alec kind of mentions Holly, anyone who's read the Bill Hodges trilogy is like, oh, you know, maybe Bill's going to show up too. And he doesn't. And I like that they actually just pull Holly for this, because it kind of leaves you wondering what happened to Bill.
And they hint at it in this book. They hint at what happened and how it all fell apart for them. But I was wondering, as I was reading it, I was like, is this telling me what the end of the last... Because this came out shortly after. Like, this was obviously written after the Mr. Mercedes trilogy.
Yeah, I think you had End of Watch, and then you had, like, Wendy's Button Box and Sleeping Beauties, and then this. So you have...
Oh, okay. That makes sense.
So you only have, you know, those two books, one being a novella, in between End of Watch and this. So, you know, it's not like a lot of time has passed, because it really seems like at this point he's kind of telling these stories in real time. So, you know, we're not going back in time to tell any of these stories. They're kind of happening whatever years he wrote them in, at least.
Yeah, it looks like the End of Watch was published in 2016, and then this came out about 2 years later. So enough time for him to write the End of Watch and then be like, eh, let's use this character. I like this character. Let's bring her into this next book and give a little closure to the previous one. So I was like, I really got to get into that Mr. Mercedes series. And then promptly didn't.
Yeah, life. And the show started in 2017, too. So that one kind of started right after the trilogy ended. So we had this live action version of Holly to see. And, you know, different portrayal in The Outsider as far as the adaptations go.
I was wondering if it would be the same person.
It is not. Very different people. But okay. I think Holly was one of those characters that people either really liked her or couldn't stand her because of her quirks that she had. And, you know, I'm just speaking from kind of what I've heard, you know, within our little horror Stephen King kind of internet friend group, if you will. And I think she's a very interesting character. Since you don't have that experience with the Bill Hodges trilogy, what did you think of Holly when she was introduced?
Oh, I just loved her. I was so excited to see her because she's not necessarily likable in a traditional way, even as, and especially not as a traditional female character. She's very, breaks all of those bounds, as you would expect from a King book, honestly. You know, she is so shrewd and isn't afraid to be, you know, upfront with people and insult people if necessary to get what she wants. And she's got so many flaws, but is also such a strong and interesting person that it really was like, that was the thing that made me the most interested in reading. And I'm still going to read it. It's just on my, it's in my pile, you know, the giant pile. She was the one I was like, I gotta know more about this character, because any book that has her in it is gonna have at least something else going on as well.
And they allude to the fact that Holly has experienced different things, let's say. And
yes.
I think they do that really well, because it doesn't give away the Bill Hodges trilogy. It doesn't spoil any of those books. Everything is alluded to extremely vaguely, so that if you have read it, you know exactly what they're talking about. But if you haven't, like you, you're kind of intrigued and you want to go read those and be like, ooh, what's this about? You know, this is definitely right. Something very, very specific that happened to this character. And, you know, we've gone for about 25 minutes here or so, and we have not even mentioned El Cuco. So
yes,
this is the big twist. There's this supernatural being who has this goo that I don't even really know. I'm still a little confused on the goo part, but basically,
yeah, the wormy goo.
When he changes form, it's not like what snakes do when they shed their skin. Instead, he just goos everywhere.
Right. And then slowly, like, mutates into the new person. And it's clear that throughout the course of the book, that it's not just that, you know, he takes on an appearance of someone. He takes on their DNA, their fingerprints, you know, their shoe size. Like, everything about them is replicated into this El Cuco.
But only after he has scratched them, usually on the back of the neck.
Yes. Yep. He has to get a blood sample from them. And there we go. And it's interesting how that's revealed, because it's just in these little bits, you know, and that you can put together. And I think that's the other thing I liked about it, is how all of those little bits add up. And just like in a good crime book, you're trying to figure out what's going on right along with the characters. And in this one, unlike in a lot of his books, King doesn't necessarily give you a whole lot more info than the characters. Like, you're kind of finding that stuff out as they do, but you're not necessarily given more information. It might not be that they believe it, but you don't necessarily know more than they do for very long in the book.
One thing with El Cuco is that, you know, King is pulling this from a very real folklore from Latin America specifically, and they get into that. And one thing I've always enjoyed about his works is how much detail goes into the research. You know, he very easily could have just made something up completely from scratch, but instead we get to see what influences him through this story. And obviously he's talked about influences in interviews and everything over the years. So he has talked about other writers he's influenced by. You know, Shirley Jackson, I believe, is a pretty big one, as many horror writers would cite. But I think...
Right, and Raymond Chandler, who was, like, one of the biggest mystery writers of his time.
So he's kind of taking these different elements and not necessarily smashing them into one novel, but he combines so many genres. And, you know, as I've been reading the more recent books, I'm like, a lot of these aren't even really rooted in horror. You know, this one, I think more so than some of the other recent stuff, like the Bill Hodges trilogy. And, you know, The Institute is like Firestarter, which, yeah, I guess telepathy and telekinesis counts as like horror.
Yeah.
A lot of people think of King as the guy who does horror, and that's kind of it. Or, you know, The Dark Tower, which is more fantasy driven. So it's kind of,
yes,
like,
yes,
even though he's made a name for himself as like the king of horror, so to speak, you get so many other genres and influences from him. And I think that really comes through in this book.
Yeah, it kind of actually reminded me of Pet Sematary, because there's a lot of that in Pet Sematary with
the Mi'kmaq.
Yes, the Mi'kmaq people and the Wendigo, which is a Native American story. And I believe that is accurate to the Mi'kmaq people. It's a little bit of realism in that it is in our world, a real fable that people tell and all of that. It adds a certain sense of realness in that it's like, oh, I could see this story, you know, on a spooky YouTube video or something like that. And it gives it this sense of more modernness and less displaced from our own reality. Because King is all about that displacement from our own reality, considering, you know, his Dark Tower series and all of that. So yeah, I thought, I always like it when he includes that stuff. And when you can tell he's done his research without reading his, you know, his little intros where he usually gives credit to the people who he called and, hey, give me all the deets about this.
Yeah, and obviously over the years he's had different people doing research for him. He's had doctors who entertain his questions, you know. He's had a lot of people help him along the way, that's for sure. But I imagine he also, just out of pure curiosity, does a lot of this research on his own, because he has always said that, you know, in order to be a great writer, you need to read a lot. And I think, yes, a lot of writers would probably agree with that, just because it makes sense. You know, I imagine comic book creators read a lot of comics, and a lot of film and TV people consume a lot of film and TV stuff, you know. So right, it just kind of goes hand in hand to see what new things people are writing about or trying. And with The Outsider, not only do you see his influences coming through and sort of these different areas he wants to explore, but it's not something that he's really done before. You know, I mentioned The Institute kind of feels like Firestarter, and I think a lot of people would agree with that, because you have the shop and The Institute and kids with the same powers, you know, or similar powers. And, you know, no one in the Institute is throwing fireballs, granted, but, you know, they still have sort of this psychic ability and it's supernatural. So with the Outsider, though, we haven't really had anything like this book. Obviously, we've had the crime stuff, but the way that this blends crime with folklore is, I think, what really grabbed me with it.
It kind of feels like this book is in two halves. There's the Terry Maitland half of the book, where they are trying to determine, you know, did Terry kill this child? If not, who did? And then Terry is murdered by Ollie. And then everything kind of switches, like you were saying earlier, where the second big event in this book, it brings all of these disparate people together who some of them were already kind of doubting. And then there were some who were like, no, he definitely did this, are all forced to reevaluate what actually happened. And then that sets them on an entirely new journey to stop this once they realize that they didn't get the right guy and this is just going to keep happening.
There's a big difference in tone, too, with the small town, everyone's looking at the Maitland family vibe, and then the middle of nowhere Texas vibe, you know? Because it's an extreme change in setting during a novel for King. You know, you don't often get that either. It's like, if something is set in Maine, it's set in Maine, you know? And this, you go from Flint City to Texas, and you know, you obviously have the hotel in the other city from when Terry was out of town, and that's his alibi, but we don't really spend too much time like outside of the hotel and the bar there, so it's really hard to consider that in the same way as you do when the characters get to Texas. And you know, you have this bouncer, and you know, Claude is someone who is also being set up, and you have all of these things going on where all of this doubt has crept in, like you said, and you have this guy who a lot of people know too, and then you're like, oh, he's being a little strange now, and oh, he's suddenly in Texas, and all of these questions are popping up. And I have to say the dynamic between Claude and his mom was just so fun, too. Like, that injected this sort of levity into the book, even though we're in the midst of a very, very serious situation. But you just can't help but laugh when you're reading some of the things his mom is saying.
Yes, his mom, Lovey, is so great. So great. And she's just, like, whip smart and very capable, even in her old age. I love that she's the one who just has no trouble believing any of this stuff. She's like, yeah, makes sense.
She's like, I've heard this folklore before.
Makes sense to me, actually. It's real.
And I wonder if that's kind of why King took it to Texas, because of its proximity to Mexico and El Cuco sort of being this Mexican boogeyman who goes after kids. Usually it's disobedient kids, which Frankie wasn't, as far as we know. You know, he was just this kid who liked baseball, and, you know, Terry was his coach.
He was
an
easy target.
Yeah, yeah. The way that this story takes a turn again as they get to Texas, and, you know, they have to keep sending Claude away. Like, he's sent to go get chicken. And
I loved that. Okay, I guess I'm going to get chicken, Ma.
And he's like, but it's going to be cold by the time I get back, because look, I can relate to that. Yes, we have food places nearby here, but it's like, if you want something that's in Colorado Springs, let's say, by the time you get back, that food is not going to be warm. So yeah. I was really feeling that moment. I was like, I understand your pain, Claude. You know, you don't want cold chicken. I don't blame you.
No. Yep. I too do not want the cold chicken. It sounds awful.
Yeah.
Yeah. And they, how it all wraps together by the end of the book, like, it starts out a little slow, but then it picks up and has a steadily increasing pace, even with those stops when they hit Texas, where, okay, now we are gonna sit down and have an explanation session.
I think it starts out slow because everyone's working under the assumption that the crime has already been solved. So then you're kind of like, okay, we got to question him. We got to read him his rights. We got to get ready to go to trial. And you're doing all this preparing for this thing that never comes. And then after that, when Terry dies, you're like, oh, oopsies.
Where are we going to go now? And, where is it going
to
go?
They have to ramp things up to 11, basically, to one, solve the crime, and two, for King to keep your attention, frankly, because this did start a little slow and I was getting a little worried. Like about a third of the way through the book, I was like, is something going to happen? And of course, I knew it was because I had seen the show, but I didn't know how the 10 episode limited series would compare in pace to the book, because 10 episodes is a lot, but also not a lot. You know, it's a good amount.
Yeah.
And for the length of this book, I think that was a good choice for the adaptation. But, you know, as soon as we get to Texas, your expectations are just like, okay, something has to happen. And we get this whole major shootout because another character we haven't even mentioned yet, Jack Hoskins. And we also have not mentioned Yoon Sablo. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. But Yoon kind of adds all of this element of, okay, I am here. I want to help. I have these other obligations. We'll see. Okay, I'm here again. We're definitely doing this. And Jack Hoskins is just like taken over, you know, mind-wise. And he is doing all of these irrational things, you know, cops at their scariest, if you will.
Yes.
Because you have two sides of the coin here, I think, because you have Ralph, who is a good detective, wants to continue being a good detective, made a very terrible mistake. And then you have Jack, who is just going completely off the rails. So you have this juxtaposition between Ralph and Jack, where they're just reacting to things in completely different ways. You know, Jack wants to get revenge on Ralph for whatever reason.
Yeah. Petty revenge, because it's definitely shown that Jack is not considered a good officer or a good detective. He can't get no respect, as they say, as Rodney Dangerfield likes to say.
And it's his fault.
It is his fault. Like, he shouldn't be getting respect. And, like, I'm pretty sure that it's hinted at that his time on the force very well may be coming to an end anyway. And then El Cuco comes to him and manipulates him and takes him over, essentially. And then you have this wild card, because he's obviously not in his right mind by the time he gets down to Texas. He's very unaware of the reality of the situation. He's just being driven by both his own petty desires and the prompting of El Cuco. And so by that final scene, or not the final scene, but by the big climactic scene where the shootout is happening, it really does feel like, okay, who's going to make it out of this? Because it's King Book, and you know somebody's going to die, probably more than one. And it could be anybody, because there's no, very rarely are there sacred people within a King Book. And this definitely, you know, definitely holds to that. A lot of people die, and it's very sad at that final moment.
Yeah, you have Jack shooting at Howie and Alec, all of them really, but because he hits the gas tank, that explodes where those two have been killed. And Yoon is wounded, not dead. And then Ralph and Holly go into this cave. There's basically like these caves that have been shut down because of probably safety reasons, you know? I mean, there was like this whole family thing and people died. And it was like this whole story that Lovey had. And you really get to this place where, again, you're kind of just in the middle of nowhere. And we're so used to King stories, yes, kind of taking place in the middle of nowhere, because Maine isn't the most populated state on the planet, or you're kind of in the mountains in Colorado and, you know, the middle of nowhere in Nebraska. So you have these locations that are often isolated in one way or another, whether it be a small town that really just stays, everyone just stays there for their lifetimes, or you're kind of in the middle of nowhere isolated like the Torrance family in The Shining. And in this instance, it's really feeling more like that Shining situation where you have all these people going into these caves, and if they call for help, it's going to be a minute before it gets there.
Right. And caves are dangerous things, even without, you know, a creepy supernatural being in there.
Yeah. It's like they closed it for a reason.
Yeah, exactly. And that comes up where they were going to kill him. But if they kill him, they run the risk of killing themselves as well with a cave in. And that feels so well thought out on the part of El Cuco that he knows that his chances, even with Jack, are fairly slim because someone has caught on to his horrible game. And so he plans so far in advance for this, and it ends up still not working for him. Thank God.
Yeah. And I just have to say, if you enjoyed the Holly and the Happy Slapper scene, you know, you have some stuff to look forward to in the Bill Hodges trilogy with Holly and the Happy Slappers. Yes. So
yes,
that was a moment where, again, if you had read those novels, you're like, yes. And you're always rooting for Holly in this scenario. There's no way you wouldn't be. But I have to admit, while all of this is happening, I almost forgot that the whole Terry Maitland thing hadn't been resolved yet. Because you think we're kind of just going to end on this big note, this big confrontation, but then you go back to Flint City and, you know, they obviously go back to the Bolton household and get their story straight first because they have time to do that since they're in the middle of nowhere.
Right. And that was something we don't often see with King. Mm-hmm. Like, we don't often see people actually being like, okay, shit, we better all decide what the hell we're going to tell the authorities. Because, I mean, they talk about it a little bit at the end of it when they're adults.
Yeah. Kids aren't going to think that through.
Right. But for the most part, like, the realities of the outside world are not necessarily such a driving force in a King book. And in this one, they are, because this one does feel like it's set more in the real world, or in our world, if you will. So it's not like some magical creature is just going to, oh, we'll just erase everybody's memories. They're dead now. Everyone's just going to forget everything.
And because of this wild, wild journey that all of these people have gone on, Samuels exonerates Terry, and, you know, they kind of have to give the public a certain story too. And you kind of see those press conferences at the end, if you will, and they're kind of just like, oh, he's good. And this happens in King novels where someone has to spin the story and they just do it so effortlessly. And you're like, I still don't like you, though.
I know. I had a lot of up and down feelings about that guy. I was like, okay, I can appreciate what you're doing, but you're also kind of a dick. But then by the end, he's able to do this thing that really just, we're going to smooth it all over and everybody's just going to move on with their lives. And it's like, well, I guess it comes in handy sometimes for the right reasons.
Yeah. What did you think of Flint City in general? Because this isn't a city we've seen before, but it still felt familiar.
It definitely has that small town vibe. I didn't necessarily, I've been to Oklahoma, but I've never actually like been in there for any significant period of time. So it didn't necessarily stand out to me like his small towns in Maine. Like, those towns always have even though you may not spend a whole lot of time in them sometimes, they always feel very fully fleshed out. And this feels a little more kind of in the background. And usually locations are a huge part of King's books. And in this one, it's not. So it's okay.
Yeah.
But I definitely felt a little bit like, what makes this town work? Because that's what I expect from a King novel. But I also think that aspect of it ties into this, what we've been talking about with it being a crime book, where there really isn't time for that in a crime book, because you are going to lose your momentum if you take all this time to really put in detail about it.
And the location jumps around a lot in this story because we're in Flint City when it starts. You know, you have the alibi in Cap City. You have the family vacation too, you know, mm-hmm. where they're trying to figure out how this van got to Flint City, and it came from Ohio, and Terry was in Ohio visiting his sick father, and you have an orderly there who killed two girls, which we didn't even mention that. And, you know, it's such a small part of the story, though, that even though it's terrible and important, you know, in the grand scheme of things, you kind of get lost in Terry and Claude's stories more than sort of all of the ancillary stuff. But that still was an important thing that happened. And, you know, we spend a decent amount of time in Ohio because Holly goes mm-hmm. there. You have Marcy sort of recounting the vacation in Ohio. And even though we aren't in Ohio, when she's telling us about it, it feels like we're there. And then you have the whole thing happening in Texas. So, you know, this isn't like It, where we're in Derry the whole time. Not the whole mm-hmm. time, but most of the time, aside yeah. from the adults going their own ways and then getting back together. You have, you know, Under the Dome. Obviously, it all happens under the dome, so you ain't going anywhere. But right. this story felt different because of how much travel goes on. A lot of his stories are kind of set in one place. Like, if we're in Castle Rock, we're in Castle Rock, you know?
Right. And it's only in something like The Stand, where yeah. the whole thing is about traveling. And he has a couple other books like that. Obviously, the Dark Tower series, most of the books are about traveling yeah. from place to place. And this definitely feels like one of those. But
not a series.
Yes, not a series. It felt, and not as travel-driven as something like The Stand is, but it's still, it just feels more centered, like I've said before, in reality. Like, there isn't nearly as much supernatural stuff. He really confines the supernatural elements to the outsider
yeah.
and his actions. And I like that we get just that little bit about Ohio and that those two girls are killed, because it kind of shows you that this isn't a new thing. You can probably trace the outsider's actions back through all of the deaths that have happened, and you mm-hmm. can see, you know, how he goes from place to place, and that gives a lot more meaning to their efforts to try to kill the outsider, in that they realize that the outsider is traveling, and that if somebody doesn't end it's not going to end, that this has just been going on and on and on and on and on.
Yeah, overall, really enjoyed this. I think I did enjoy it because it was so different, too. You know, mm-hmm. different locations, different scenario, different way of incorporating this supernatural force. And, you know, obviously still horrific, terrible things happen in this novel. But yeah, I would probably say that this is not necessarily top tier King for me, but it's sort of like the mid to high tier, which I think I've given a lot of things fours through this process. But this is sitting at a 4 for me, 4 out of 5.
Yeah, I think I'm there with you. I think 4 out of 5 because of how different it is, and how willing, as I've said before on this podcast, I love it when King tries new things, and he's a man who is kind of always trying new things. He's not just a horror author, he's not just a supernatural author, he is always pushing himself to tell a new kind of story. And I think I really liked how he blends the two in this one. And there aren't a whole lot of references to other King material outside of Holly's character with Mr. Mercedes, which is unusual. Even in his, you know, even in The Green Mile, we see little bits connected to his whole world. And one of the things I read that I wanted to ask you about, do you think that the outsider creature is part of the macroverse, part of, you know, the dark place that Pennywise comes from, and all of those creatures that he references who live on death and sadness and fear?
Given what they revealed about the folklore behind El Cuco, I think that's very possible. But at the same time, because we know this is sort of derived from Latin America, I think it could be either or, because this is something that's like real. Like, you can go look this up right now and read about it. This is like something that he researched and incorporated into the story, like we mentioned earlier. So it's not made up by him in the same way that Pennywise is. So that's my only thought process as to why it maybe wouldn't be.
Right. And I liked that ambiguity of, because it does feel like a king kind of villain or creature. But because it has, because after I read the book, you know, I went to Wikipedia and was typing it in and like, ooh, this is really fascinating. Like I did after I read Pet Sematary more recently, and all that, I was like, oh, this is real. Oh my God. You know, and I love how it twists it. And I really like it when there's that ambiguity of like, this very well could be something that's part of Stephen King's, you know, bigger universe, but it also is something that feels a part of our world. And that is kind of a rarity with King. Like, usually when you read a King book, you are brought into King's world. This feels like it straddles a line between being in King's world and being in our world. And that's, I think I'm seeing that when I've read more of his more recent books, I feel like I'm seeing that a little bit more than we did, you know, back in the 90s and before then.
Yeah, it seems like some of the stuff he's written more recently is maybe a little less connected to this whole sort of macroverse, Dark Tower universe, whatever you want to call it. And you could still see ways in which it would be. But yeah, this one was interesting for so many reasons that we've mentioned here.
Yeah. And I looked at some reviews, and it definitely had its detractors, who people who really didn't like it, who thought it was boring and didn't come together. And I was like, I guess I can see that. But
I think the slow start could turn some people off of the book.
But I'm also I also really enjoy crime novels and enjoy these kinds of stories. Same. So, and I love Stephen King. So I was kind of like in the bag for this. I was like, yeah, even if it's slow, it'll pick up. It's not, I could tell immediately, and here's my obligatory reference, that it is not a Tommyknockers. Tommyknockers also starts incredibly slow and never stops being slow. And in that, you could tell as you, after you, halfway through it, you can look back and be like, oh God, all the signs were there.
Yeah.
And in this, there's none of those. I could tell reading it, this is going to pick up. Things are being lined up for me right now through this story that are then going to yield fruit later on.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, right now, as of the time we are recording this, I'm rereading If It Bleeds, which has a Holly Gibney novella in it. So I'm looking forward to that. Ooh. And then I have Later and Billy Summers to read. And then I am done with the novels. And it is wild. By the time you're all listening to this, though, there's a good chance that I am done.
Well, no. There'll be another one coming out already.
Yeah, there's a third Gwendy's book coming out next year, but I will be done for at least like 5 months. I get a break.
It'll be, yes, a serious break. That'll be nice for you.
Yeah, yeah. I guess I need to pick up the second Gwendy book at some point.
You'll get to it. You'll get to it.
Yeah, not in a hurry. It's not by King, but, you know, still need to read it before I read the one that King returns to.
Yes, that's right. I forgot he didn't write the second one.
Yeah, but Katie, thank you so much for joining me. You will be back for Lisi's story, at least. And, you know, I look forward to talking to you about that one as well.
Me too. Thanks for having me.
All right, that does it for this episode of Chat Cemetery. You can support the podcast on Patreon for $1 a month. You'll get a thank you on the show. For $2 a month, I will send you a Chat Cemetery sticker. And if you want to follow us on social media, you can do so at Chat Cemetery on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. You could also rate and review the show. That's a huge help. And as always, thank you for listening, and we hope you enjoy the rest of your day.